This is Michael Zapersky of FreshGigs.ca, and today I'm very happy to be here with Penelope Trunk. Penelope is the author of Brazen Careerist, founder of the website with the same name, and a very fine blogger at PenelopeTrunk.com. Let me just say that you write a lot on Gen Y and issues around careers and job hunting, and I want to get your thoughts on some specifics in that area, because I know you offer a lot of really good advice and value for both job seekers and employers. But before we get to that, I first want to ask you about life. And you've said that if you want to have a good life, you shouldn't focus on happiness, but rather on making your life interesting. Can you just talk a little bit about why you say that?
Well, the first thing is we can't really control how happy we are. 75% of our happiness is from our DNA. And this research comes from the Harvard Happiness Lab and the Happiness Research Foundation at University of California, San Diego. They both separately came to the conclusion that we can influence very little of how happy we are. So all that stuff about, like, learn to be more optimistic and resilient and blah, 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 it impacts so little of how we look at our life. So you're either a glass empty or glass full person, right? And there's not a lot of benefit to training yourself to think the other way. It's like when we used to train left-handed people to write with their right hand. It's just a useless cause. So instead, what we should look at is that people who are, there's some people, and they generally live in the Midwest and not in big cities. They're content. They generally, whatever they have is good, and they are able to make do and make contentment with whatever they have. Other people are maximizers, and they want the best of everything, and they're generally unhappy. So, for example, in the U.S., the most unhappy people are in New York City. However, they're also generally the most interesting people. They challenge everything. They have very difficult lives. They're living in New York City and paying crazy rents and crazy taxes because they want to be around doers and inventors and risk takers. And so, in general, most people are not on the very happy end of the spectrum, and in general, most people are more satisfied in life by being interested and stimulated, and it's like oppressive to tell people that they should be happier because you're born with how happy you're going to be. And
right.
Here's a really interesting thing about how little happiness changes. If you become a quadriplegic, your happiness dips while you get used to it, but then your happiness level goes right back to the same level because we have kind of a happiness set point, kind of like our weight set point. You can lose tons of weight, but you'll just go back to where you were.
So this is pretty revolutionary. I mean, there's a huge business out there of people, selling books, conferences, events of all kinds around helping people to be happier. And what you're saying is that a lot of that really doesn't influence or won't impact how happy people become because it's set in their DNA for a large part of
it. Right. Yeah, it's unfortunate that, like, the message of you're as happy as you're going to be is not really a big seller.
Mm-hmm.
And so people would rather pay money to hear that they're going to be happier. But I think that what people, it just starts to frustrate people and waste a lot of time. And I think we just need to reframe, well, what's a good life? And a good life is, for most people, when they're engaged and interested. And the whole happiness thing is like a, what's that thing in Plato's cave where, like, you could touch it, but it's not, you could see it, but you can't touch it, it's not there, like an illusion or something in Plato's cave? I don't know.
Oh,
red herring. Right. There, it's a better example. Happiness is a red herring because
right.
We're not really, we don't really have a clear definition of happiness, but if you push people for it, they would say it's, like, engaged, feeling engaged and useful, actually.
So let me ask you, because for all the job seekers out there, I mean, you suggest that the way to find a job that you love, which obviously is tied into happiness, is to ask yourself what you want to learn next. Why do you recommend that approach?
Well, you're not going to find a job that you love. You can't, like, do what you love. I just don't believe in that. I don't think people get paid to do what they love. I think you do that for free because you love it. And we're generally the same types of people. Most people love sex. They love eating, and they don't get paid for either. So I don't think you're going to get paid to do what you love. But if you think about what you want to learn next, you'll be engaged in your work. And in general, work doesn't make us happy, but work definitely makes us unhappy. And it's, like, definitely boring to go to work where you're not learning because it's not interesting.
So people should really, what you're suggesting is they should think about not trying to necessarily find that ideal job of what they think, you know, that they're going to just love doing. But when they're looking for a job, consider more what would they find interesting, where can they learn, where can they grow. That's the approach that you're recommending?
Yeah, well, the ideal job is a job that you can learn at.
Right.
And I think people really underestimate the range of jobs you can learn at. So you can pretty much learn at any job. If you've been there 5 years, you're not learning. The learning curve dramatically flattens after 2 years. So you can have the coolest job in the world, but if you've been there for more than 2 years, you're learning less than you would learn flipping burgers at McDonald's.
Okay, so now I have to stop you because I want to save this for later, but it's going to tie in very nicely to what we're talking about right now. I'm going to quote you here. You said, staying in one job forever is today's recipe for career suicide. What's going on there?
Well, your learning curve flattens. After 2 years, your learning curve starts to dramatically flatten. After 5 years, you don't have a learning curve. I mean, unless you're moving up in an organization, in a big organization, extremely fast. Mm-hmm. You don't have a learning curve. And in fact, this is so pronounced that the best companies force you to change jobs every 2 years. If they have a high performer that they want to keep, they'll force you to change jobs every 2 years, or they'll promote you to keep you learning.
Right.
So in this, it used to be that you keep a job for 40 years, and the company invests in you and decides how much you need to learn in order to stay employed for 40 years. But now, companies don't make that promise to you, and so you're responsible for keeping yourself employable, and that requires you to be responsible for your learning curve. So it's in the company's best interest to train someone for a year or two, and then keep them doing the exact same thing for the next 10 years with no promotion and no education and no anything, because you're totally efficient at it. There's no more training costs. But that's really bad for you. Because when the company's done with you, you will not have learned anything. You've just been a cog in the wheel for the company.
So what would you suggest that the job seeker, the employee in this scenario does, if they're at a company where they're starting to feel they've kind of maxed out, that they're not learning as much, but they like the company's culture, the brand, you know, they still want to be a part of it. They don't want to necessarily change companies, but they want to, you know, they're not feeling stimulated. What would you recommend that they do in that situation?
They have to leave. That's ridiculous. They like the company, but there's nowhere for them to go. They have to leave. There's a lot of fish in the sea. It's like you fall in love with a guy, and the guy dumps you, and you know, the first time that happens, you think you're never going to fall in love again, but there are tons of guys you'll fall in love with. And if you love one company, you'll love a million companies. It's just the company doesn't love you enough to make a new job for you to keep you learning and stimulated, so you need to not love the company because they don't love you enough to make a new job. I mean, it's just ridiculous. It what you're really asking is, well, what if you feel really comfortable where you are? Well, then that's bad. If you feel comfortable, it means you're not learning anything. It's like if you love going to therapy. Well, anyone who tells me they love going to therapy, I know they're not getting anything done in therapy. If you hate therapy, that means every time you go, you're learning something new.
You're suggesting that people should really, when they're at work, they should be feeling, you know, a bit pressured or getting pushed or uncomfortable, and that's really where the learning comes from.
Yeah, you should be unsure of yourself, a little unsure that you can do what you're trying to do. If you're not unsure that you can accomplish what you're trying to accomplish, then where's the excitement in accomplishing it? Then you're just punching a time clock.
Okay, Penelope, I want to get a little bit more tactical here. You know, we see thousands of resumes here at FreshGigs.ca. Can you share a few tips and what people should keep in mind when, you know, when it comes to the resume and cover letter?
The recruiter's job go through a ton of resumes and, like, compare apples to apples and then fit the person into the job that's open. So if you try to be really creative, you just make someone's life really hard. So boring resume to me seems fine. It's just that you need to follow the format and be the best person at it. So if you don't follow a typical format, you just look like you're hiding stuff. So it should just be at the top a summary of who you are, and then it should be the company and your position at it, and three or five bullets on what you did. And I think the two most common mistakes are, first of all, that people try to tell their life story on a resume, and it's not your life story, it's a marketing document. So everything you sucked at, you should leave out, and you should figure out the best version of the story of you and how you got to be you, and then anything that doesn't fit in that, you leave out. So if you're great at technology, if you're a great, job programmer, and you also, like, launched this ballet company and you did all the marketing for it, whatever, just leave it off, because no one's going to hire you to launch the ballet company again. So if you want to get hired for doing technology, have all your stuff be for what you're going to be hired for. Nobody needs to know that you launched a ballet company and can market ballerinas. And, I mean, unless you want to, like, also get hired to do that. Okay, so the one thing is people feel that they have to put everything of their life story on the resume, and it makes for a bad story. The Right. other thing that people do that I think is bad is they put a description of what they did in the bullet instead of an achievement. So a good resume will just have huge achievements in the bullets, and it won't say exactly what a person did. But nobody really cares exactly what you did. They're not your mom. They just want to know if you're a high performer or not. And if you write what you did exactly, that doesn't reveal if you're a high performer. It reveals that you showed up for work and did what you were told to do. But high performers always do more than that. So you just want to write what you did that was more than that, so that you look like a high performer. And anything that's on your resume that isn't an achievement is just a waste of space, because you don't want the recruiter's eye to land on that. You only get 10 seconds.
Right. And how about specialization? Should people specialize or be generalists when they're considering their career?
Well, you can't be a generalist after probably 29. You just look retarded. So most people don't feel like a generalist by the time they're 29, but you can... A good career coach, or even if you have a friend who's good at it, can look at your work history and see how they can write a resume that turns you into a specialist. So much of this is about storytelling, and someone who's not you is going to be much better at crafting your story than you are. Like, our own stories seem so intricate and complicated to us because we have way too much information. But to an outsider, it's just so obvious what the story should be.
Many people listening to this will be considering a change in career, and I know on your blog you offer 7 tips to choose a new career. Can we touch on maybe 2 or 3 of the most important ones that you feel that, you know, are relevant to the vast majority of people?
The number one thing is that it needs to make you the amount of money you want to make. That people think they're, like, overwhelmed with how many choices they can have, and the world is so vast and their interests are so wide, and really it's not like that. It's like, well, what's the intersection of what you're interested in and what you can get paid for? And in the Venn diagram of, like, most people are interested in what they're good at, you know, take the Myers-Briggs test, find out what you're truly good at instead of what you wish you were good at, and then look at the intersection of what you're truly good at and what you can get paid for. So that's your limitation right there, and then the world becomes actually very small. And then you look at that list and say, okay, well, which of those does your prior experience sort of touch on? So if you went to a career coach, I mean, I coach tons of people that want to change careers, and because they've been telling the story of their first career for so long, they don't see that tucked into their history is actually tons of stuff about a viable second career. And they could just rewrite their whole resume to look like they've been doing this second career forever. And so that's the career change that you should make. So the first step is, what's the intersection of what you're talented at and what pays a lot? And then the next step is, what's the intersection of that group of things and what you've already done? And that's your strongest career change. And, like, it would be great if, like, we were all 10 years old and we could do anything in the whole world, but that's not how the world works. And so we're much better off just devoting our career change energies to what's possible, because we don't need to do what we love. We can do what we love for free, and we can do what's possible and lucrative and interesting for a job.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. I think that's great advice for people. Penelope, thanks so much for doing this interview.
Thanks a lot.
And you take care and have a great day.
Okay, thanks. Bye-bye.
Cheers. Bye for now.